Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the briefings that I value most each week is that we receive from Diana West, one of our regulars here. Usually we find her on Wednesdays. It's always a pleasure to do so. She is, of course, a best-selling author of two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. She is now found at dianawest.net and the Daily Caller and elsewhere, a longtime syndicated columnist and great friend of this program and of moi. It's always good to have her with us. Diana, welcome back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you.
So you've been doing some important writing. It's hard to overstate its importance at a moment when socialism seems to be getting a makeover and as a result garnering popularity, particularly among young Americans. I'd just like to do a little taxonomy here, if I could, Diana. Tell us what the difference is, as a practical matter, between communism, socialism, democratic socialism, progressivism, Alinskyism. I mean, is there a dime's worth of difference, really, between what these various strains of the hard left's, you know, totalitarian ideologies are?
Well, I think on the left, they see many gradations of difference, and they argue about it, and they oppose each other and contend for favor and victory over each other. But as far as good old-fashioned anti-communist Americans go, no, there is no difference. Socialism has the same ends as communism. We are led to believe this is usually through democratic approaches on the socialist side of things, but essentially both kinds of doctrines, which really are the same doctrine, go toward a centrally controlled government system that controls increasingly all manners of culture and politics and speech and banking and finance and the rest of it, education. So it's all on the same road. So as far as Americans go, no, they should really not be troubled by the differences.
And to the extent that this sort of repackaged socialism, democratic socialism, I think it's being called by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, notably at the moment a candidate for Congress from the Bronx. Does that mark a more radical strain of socialism than old-fashioned socialism? Is it, again, possible to make any particular distinction between it and old-fashioned communist sort of totalitarianism in new models, perhaps?
No, I don't think there really is any reason to look for these gradations. In fact, one thing that really struck me is that her agenda, as she's enumerated it when she was first running in her primary, is very similar to what we see in the largest caucus of Democrats on Capitol Hill, the Progressive Caucus. Their people, they call it the people's budget. The items in the people's budget of already elected Democrats, they call themselves Democrats, is strikingly similar to Ocasio-Cortez's agenda as a democratic socialist. So in other words, what we're looking at are the Trojan horse socialists who call themselves Democrats. What we're seeing in this election cycle is a great deal more openness, sort of the defig leafing, if you will, of Democrats coming out as democratic socialists and socialists. But again, we're looking at already the effects of it long over this past century in our system, and now we're looking at a very aggressive campaign to call it what it is, which I think is a good thing because it'll, I hope, wake people up. But we're already suffering under it, and now we're seeing just a more aggressive campaign to further these ends.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about something that you wrote about recently, Diana West, at your site. Communism is as socialism does, and vice versa. You referred to a René Wormser, who was involved with a congressional investigation back when we're still concerned about subversion by the communists and their fellow travelers. Specifically, the Rees Committee was his employer at the time, and he was looking into the role that foundations were playing in the academy in terms of essentially in insinuating this socialist pedagogy, the education. Are we reaping the whirlwind now with young people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Dinah West, as a result of what has been done to our education system by these foundations, among other things?
Absolutely. And one thing that this committee, the Rees Committee, approved in these investigations, which took place in 1954, they proved that this seizure of key aspects of the foundation world, this would be the Ford Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and on, key aspects of the monies that they were distributed had been essentially co-opted by, we can call them democratic socialists or Marxists, New Dealers for sure, but the far left in terms of promoting a socialist agenda among history teachers, social studies departments, and on and on. And we already were reaping the whirlwind back in the 1950s, and this many generations later, yes, we don't even feel the strength of the whirlwind anymore. It's so completely all enveloping. So yes, this is what was going on. And Renee Wormser wrote a great book about, based on the hearings, with many excerpts from the hearings, called Foundations, which is actually available free online if people want to check it out. It's very instructive.
Well, I commend it to you all because it is an insight into how we've gotten into the present fix, where so many on the younger side of the American demographic are now clueless about socialism, or certainly do not understand the horror that it has brought under whichever banner it's marching at the moment. Dinah, lastly and quickly, there is another facet of this which I also wanted to get your thoughts on, and that is the connection that increasingly is evident between these leftists and what I think of as Sharia supremacists, the folks who seek to replace our Constitution, whether they acknowledge it or not, with Islam's doctrine of Sharia. We call this the red-green axis at the Center for Security Policy. It's evident at the moment in the campaigning by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, one-time and perhaps future presidential candidate, for a candidate for the governor of Michigan by the name of Abdul El-Sayed, who has been associated in the past, at least, with the Muslim Brotherhood and seems to be pretty much on the Sharia team. What are your thoughts about that connection between them and the implications?
Well, again, it's very instructive for Americans to understand the theoretical and political overlap between Islam and Marxism in terms of both isms promoting the collective to the disadvantage, to the elimination of the individual, of individual liberty. There's great synergy and commonality between the religion of Islam and the doctrine of Marxism, and this is something that makes them natural allies in this red-green axis.
Dinah, thank you so much for your time today. As always, come back to us again next week. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we will speak with Harold Rode about rising threats to Israel and what it might mean for you, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Dr. Harold Rode, one of our duty experts here at the Center for Security Policy and Secure Freedom Radio, on matters involving the Middle East, a subject in which he has devoted his professional life with great effect to mastering, monitoring, and advising about, notably in senior positions in the Office of the Secretary of Defense from 1994 to 2010. He was, among other things, a member of the staff of the highly regarded Net Assessment Organization, in OSD, as it's called these days. He is a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute. He He is also the author of an important, relatively recent book, Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Rode, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Always great hearing your voice, Frank.
Thank you. Let me talk to you first and foremost, Harold, about Israel. You spend a lot of time there. I'm sure you've got a very keen appreciation for what it means to the Israelis, once again, to find themselves under siege, really, or even worse, under attack, notably from the Gaza Strip in the form of rockets and fire kites and the like, increasingly from Iranian or Iranian-backed forces across the Golan Heights in Syria. I'm just wondering what your take is, Harold, on the fact that these threats seem to be intensifying, as does the prospect of a really horrific conflict with Hezbollah out of Lebanon.
Well, right now in Israel, there is an increasing sense among the people that it would not be surprised, let's say, there is some form of war in the near future. I don't know what the near future means, because as you say, everything, the tension is all over the place. The most, I would say, long-term important thing is Syria. And the Israelis have said that they don't want Iran anywhere near the Israeli border. The Russians and maybe the Americans have said something like 80 kilometers, that's about 50 miles. But that isn't enough, because the point is, in today's world with rockets and missiles and all that, it's much, much easier from anywhere. So it wouldn't be surprising to me that we see Israel increasingly active against Iranian presence anywhere in Syria in the near future.
Well, it sounds right, and it certainly sounds needed. It's just a question of, can they do it? And what do you make, Harold, of the putative agreement between Vladimir Putin of Russia and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, with regard to exercising some kind of control over the Iranians in Syria? Is that, in fact, in effect, as you see it? And if so, to what effect?
I don't know if such an agreement exists, but put it this way. It seems that Netanyahu has been able to develop a very useful relationship with Putin. It wouldn't surprise me, though I don't know that he at times would even be an intermediary with President Trump on this issue. The reason is he's got good relations with both sides. Most importantly to Israel, though, there's no question, it's America that matters to Israel. There's no country, no nothing, no place like America. The Israeli people have a deep, deep respect and love for the United States and admiration for President Trump. So we'll see. We'll see what happens in the future.
Let me ask you about something else that has been on the horizon for some time, and there are some reports to the effect that it may be at hand, and that is the end of the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan. The king of Jordan, Abdullah's long been riding a tiger of Palestinian and Sharia supremacist aspirations. Talk a little bit about his future prospects, and should he depart the scene, Harold, one way or the other, what it might mean for that situation we were just discussing vis-a-vis Israel.
If Jordan wishes to continue to involve itself in the Palestinian issue, it really, in the end, can be of little use to Israel. Because whatever goes on in the West Bank or in Jerusalem, the Jordanians keep saying unbelievably negative things, especially the king. Now, the truth is that Jordan has been an artificial creation from the very beginning. The British simply lopped off a part of Palestine, I think it was 1921 or 22, and gave it to a Hashemite ruler to whom the British felt some debt. Now, is it necessary that Jordan survives? If the Jordanian king were to concentrate on his relationship with the tribes in Jordan, and that is the bottom line, because the Jordanian tribes are the ones who have power. What scares me, if I could say, is that in riots from time to time, you have some of his biggest tribal supporters criticizing him, criticizing the government. I don't know where this is going to go. But Jordan has managed to muddle through. And the truth is, most people believe, and I think there's some rationale for this, that Jordan is run by the CIA. It's the CIA that keeps Jordan in power because America believes it's in America's interest that it survive.
Yeah. Well, that little king, as he's been called, is an ally in an area that we don't have many, and we've armed him to the teeth, and the prospect of his departure and those arms falling into unfriendly hands is an ominous one for Israel as well as, I believe, for our interests. Harold, let me turn quickly to Iran. You have spent much of your career studying there, studying it, and as I say, explaining to the rest of us what to make of it, including the Secretary of Defense for quite some protracted period of time. What is your current reading of the state of the kleptocracy, the mullahs run there, and the exposing of it that the Trump administration has been doing of late, and most especially the prospects that the people of Iran are going to find a way to liberate themselves from this blight to them and threat to us?
Well, I deeply admire the Trump administration's policy towards Iran. It is slowly but surely squeezing this government. On August 6th, the sanctions will, a huge round of sanctions comes into effect, and I wouldn't want to be the Iranian government at the moment having to deal with such things. Now, if you want an up-to-date where the Iranian people are vis-a-vis their horrific terrorist government, yesterday, there were big riots in Isfahan, a very important city in central Iran. And the rallying cry, the slogans that they were shouting was, Reza Shah, your spirit is happy. Now, what does this mean? Iranian culture is a very subtle culture. And by bringing up Reza Shah, who was the founder of the previous dynasty, that this regime, the Islamic Republic, overthrew, is in itself, that they had dared to do such things, is scary for the regime. Now, to say that the regime should be happy, or that people, rather, are saying that Reza Shah should be happy, they're in essence saying, we want a regime like that one. Reza Shah did wonderful things for Iran, and his son was Mohammad Reza Shah. That was the last Shah of Iran. And his grandson, who was a really very nice human being and could be, his name is Reza Shah. Reza Shah, he's named after his grandfather. And the Iranian people in their subtleties are saying, are we talking about Reza Shah, the founder of the dynasty, or the young Shah who lives now in the United States? He would be an excellent force to support as glue to keep the country going. Those who argue that we should support different ethnic minorities within Iran, I think, are doing America and the Iranian people a huge disservice. And it is, we hear this from time to time. And the reason is that Iran is a culture, it is a country. And the moment that people try to divide it, we are in essence helping the present government of Iran, which is telling its people that the America, Israel, and all these other bad guys in their eyes are trying to divide up the country. So I would argue we need something, a glue, like a king who, shall we say, reigns but not rules. Someone that the Iranian people can focus on that will help return Iran to the community, international community of nations that we can get along with, that there won't be problems. And I strongly believe that that's what the Trump administration is accomplishing slowly but surely, but in the right way.
Yeah. Let me ask you just to drill down for a moment there on the opposition, Harold Rowe, because there are a number of entities or coalitions that are now jockeying for position in the West to, you know, have a role or maybe even form the next government should the current one be removed from power. What do you make of the group known as the MEK?
Islamic terrorists. Islamic Marxist terrorists. There's not much more to say. They're a cult. They are very well connected within Iran. But I, from my reading and from my talking with all sorts of Iranians, most Iranians hate them. Are we going to go from the frying pan into the fire? That's the last people that I believe, should support. But if they can be useful in helping bringing this regime down, that's fine. But in no way afterwards should we offer them any support.
Yeah. And this other group, and I must say I can't keep the name straight, but it's a coalition of opposition Iranians or something to that effect. I've been told that it has some connection to Reza Pahlavi, the grandson of Reza Shah. Is that your understanding as well? And is that a group that you have some confidence in?
Iranians have a tremendous sense of where power is shifting. If we support a coalition of these groups, it wouldn't be surprising to me that Iranians wake up tomorrow and start shouting for this group. The truth is that once this regime meets its death, the Iranian regime, the Iranian people, there are going to be all sorts of upheavals, and we'll see who emerges. Power pours a vacuum, and all we care about is that whatever leadership that is in power in Iran does not oppress its people and wants to get along with the outside world.
Harold Rode, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as I am pleased to say, we have the chance to be from time to time by Robert Charles. He is these days the president and managing member of the Charles Group, LLC. You frequently catch appearances of him on Fox News and elsewhere. He is a former Assistant Secretary of State in charge of international narcotics and law enforcement affairs in the George W. Bush administration. He was also, prior to that, a naval intelligence officer. He's a litigator. He's worked in the Reagan and Bush 41 White Houses. A man of many parts, including, most recently, the author of a new book, which we had the privilege of discussing at some length with him last week, Eagles and Evergreens. You can pre-order it now, and I hope you will. Robert Charles, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Your background, particularly at State, but in some of your previous incarnations as well, is very much of value at the moment as we're trying to make sense of what's going on with respect to what has now been kind of euphemistically defined by two words, the wall. Of course, President Trump, as a candidate, ran on building one across our southern border. He has been working, I think, manfully, if not quite as successfully as any of us would like, on fulfilling that promise as president. He says he might shut down the government over it. He's clearly pressing Congress to do something about it. Remind us why this is so important for our homeland security, our national security, and the, well, public safety of the American people.
Happily. Frank, you know, you touched on a lot of things there, and they're all valid and relevant. The border, any border, frankly, is what gives a nation state its presence. You know, up here in New England, we often say that good fences make good neighbors, paraphrasing Robert Frost. And the idea is that you have predictability and you have mutual respect when you come to a border. We have a river of humanity that flows north. We have a very prosperous economy. And so what happens is, aside from legal immigration, we have people who are constantly trying to game the system and illegally gain from our benefits. It's rather ironic when you look at places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Mexico. They all protect their own borders. If you travel down through, as I have, the Pan-American Highway, or you travel from state to state, ground transport, never mind air transport, you will find that there is a heavily guarded presence on all of those borders. So they don't misunderstand the value of borders. They understand it. And we, I think, collectively as a nation, understand it too. And most Americans understand the significance of a wall. The wall is philosophically and also practically, the wall protects us from, it protects our nation state, but it also protects us from things like narcotics traffickers who have taken every effort now to penetrate every single county in the country. And, you know, there isn't an American that will listen to this broadcast who isn't in a place that is suffering from the intrusion and in many ways this sort of vast wave now of heroin and cocaine trafficking as well as marijuana from the South. Of course, we've got some states that have taken a true left turn and put themselves in a very bad position because crime is rising, drug driving is rising, all kinds of things are rising in states like Colorado and elsewhere where they've legalized marijuana. But the reality is that the wall is served many purposes. And, you know, I'll just give credit to the president. I speak periodically with CBP and ICE and other folks and DEA and others.
Talking about Customs and Border Patrol and Drug Enforcement Agency, right?
Yes. And they are fully committed to the idea of the wall. Indeed, they're going through prototypes. They're coordinating with each other well. The problem is that the United States Congress is being obstructed by some people, particularly from states like California, Oregon, you know, Colorado, Illinois, Rhode Island, that are stopping something that truly must ultimately be done. You know, I spent time, which is to protect the border. And, you know, and the wall is such a simple, straightforward way. It's electronic. It's physical. It's what we would always expect. It's what we call smart rather than muscular. You could put the National Guard at every, you know, 10 yards on the border, but that's not smart. That's muscular. That's actually what a lot of countries do because they don't have the technology and they don't have the building capacity. We have that. And so, you know, my feeling is, first off, give the president some credit. He has done everything in his power at the moment to drive forward the construction of this border protection. The United States Congress is being obstructed by a few who ultimately ought to put this. There are going to be 14 working days left after they get back from their August recess. They ought to put this wall money into that remaining set of bills and get them out in regular order. We have a two-year budget agreed by the budget committee. We just don't have the appropriations done yet. And to your point about what can the president now do, you know, look at those states, California, Oregon, Colorado, Illinois, Rhode Island, and New Mexico. None of them voted for Trump, and yet he is here trying to support them. They're all sanctuary states. That actually, by definition, is the group that is the sanctuary states. They voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. So, ironically, if he could link specific federal benefits to specific outcomes, so I won't go into details on that now, but if he could do that, he could actually restrict, I think, some of the funding to those states that's coming from the federal level. And not to beat around the bush here, California spends, the California state budget is one-third federal money. So folks like you and me and people from Maine and Virginia and Maryland and all over the country are paying for that one-third of California's budget, which they devote part of it to obstructing the federal government, these sanctuary cities, legalizing drugs, and not protecting their border. You know, so let's get straight to the facts here. The president is doing the right thing, full on, four square. He's doing the right thing. But what he needs is support from the Democrats in Congress who have to take a deep breath and say, look, do we or don't we believe in borders? These are the same people, Frank, who would haul me up before them to testify about why we weren't doing a better job of protecting the Colombian border or the Venezuelan border or the Peruvian border or the Ukrainian border. And so, you know, if we believe that other countries in the world should have and respect each other's borders, then we surely should believe that of our neighbors. And good fences make good neighbors.
Yeah, you, I think, are speaking from experience as well as poetry. Let me just ask you, there is an idea that I have been encouraging the administration to countenance and hopefully adopt as an interim step, not as to supplant the wall, that physical barrier, but to begin reconstituting a capability that was operating along the Texas border with Mexico for a number of years, a few years back. It's called Blue Servo. And it simply is a system of cameras, high-grade cameras, military-grade cameras that provide feed to the internet. And back during the period that it was operating in Texas, there was a very, very large number of eyes put on monitoring the border through those cameras. And helping law enforcement, Customs, Border Patrol, what have you, effect a very high percentage intercepts of people coming across it illegally. It seems to me that even if there is no money at the moment to finish building out the physical barrier, this is something that could be done. I'm told within 45 days, the cameras in Texas could be back on. And it just seems to me, and I'd be appreciative for your thoughts on this, Robert Charles, that as part of a longer-term strategy, but most especially as part of doing something now to try to help slow that torrent of people coming across our southern border, whether for innocent reasons or for malevolent ones, in either case, illegally, this would be an important useful step. Your thoughts?
No, you're absolutely right, Frank. The idea of the cameras on the border, which were much more robust in the past, Blue Servo, it makes perfect sense. It's not the whole solution, but it is a partial solution. And I'll tell you, what you're really pointing to is that before you solve any problem, you have to stop looking away from it and look directly into it, and then you have to address, you know, the can or the how. And part of that is the wall. Part of it is visibility. What you're really pointing to is that you have a very cost-effective force multiplier in cameras, because people, particularly if they're publicly accessible, everyone becomes a participant in the process. The other thing you do is you create accountability. And ultimately, we don't have that right now.
Yeah, too true. Let me switch gears for the last couple of minutes we have with you, Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State. You have served in senior ranks of the United States government, and you know from firsthand experience the value of the team that a president surrounds himself with to help with the execution, particularly of national security policy. I have great regard, as I think you do, for the members of the team the president has now got in place, particularly at the NSC and at the State Department and Mike Pompeo. I wonder what you would advise the president. Well, I don't wonder. I know what you would advise the president, because I saw your piece at Fox News about it. But talk a little bit about the importance for this president's success to be taking full advantage of these people working for him.
Absolutely. The best leader in the world is the leader, whether this is in business, in education, in government, is someone who pulls people smarter than they are, if they can find them, around them, delegates properly, divides the labor, and listens closely to the advice that he or she is getting so that they can make the right decision. And President Trump and Vice President Pence have done a remarkable job of pulling extraordinary people around them. James Mattis, probably the most decorated Marine and most sage. They call him the scholar monk in the military community. Just an extraordinary leader, operationally and scholastically, and a brilliant guy. John Kelly is, I can't say enough about John Kelly that's good. John Kelly has personally, and with his family and with his entire life, given his life to America.
Another Marine four-star who's now Chief of Staff at the White House, of course. Robert Charles, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for sharing your insights, particularly about the importance of the wall, with us. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Gordon Chang. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia, especially as they bear on the security of the United States, economic as well as national. He is, of course, Gordon Chang, the author of two terrific books on the subject. One, The Coming Collapse of China. The other, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You can find his writings these days at places like The Daily Beast and National Interest. You often see him at Fox, and we're always pleased that he's with us week upon week. Gordon, thank you for joining us. Good to have you back.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
A couple of things are on my mind, Gordon. I just wanted to touch base with you about. We had a chance to talk at length with our colleague Stephen Mosier the other day, and he said something very pointedly that I thought was worth just emphasizing and getting your take on. He said that when, in 1991, the leader of Communist China at the time, the so-called Red Emperor, Deng Xiaoping, saw the collapse of the Soviet Union, he declared something to the effect of the Cold War with the United States and the Soviet Union is over, the Soviet Union lost. Now we will have a Cold War with the United States and we will win. And that basically going forward from that moment, Stephen argued that we have seen China at war with the United States, something we have generally chosen to ignore or at least not acknowledge and respond to. Sound right to you?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Clearly on the trade front, Beijing has been trying to undermine the U.S. economy for decades. And we don't call it a trade war. Matter of fact, people now say this is President Trump starting a trade war. Whatever terminology one wants to use, we've got to acknowledge that China has been stealing U.S. intellectual property to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Their forced transfers, their attempts to take U.S. companies and close them out of the Chinese market. There's all sorts of things, Frank. And so, therefore, I think that we can say that Beijing has been determinedly trying to undermine the U.S. You know, when you look at geopolitics, the story is pretty much the same. China is doing things which are inconsistent with a member of the international community. And now even Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has been dropping hints that only China is a sovereign state and everybody else needs to pay tribute to Beijing. So clearly, you know, whatever you call it, nonetheless, China is working in ways which undermine not only the United States, but also the international order.
Yeah. And one of the things that, again, bears emphasizing is something Stephen dwelled on at length, and that is the actual historical continuity going back to the 21st century BC, as I understand it, of Chinese emperors really regarding themselves as the center of the universe and the rest of the world is required to submit to them. So this is sort of a back to the future, I guess, kind of deal under Xi Jinping and the communists, but one that we ignore at our extreme peril. And it's one of the reasons we value so much our opportunities to talk with you about these things, Gordon Chang, because you don't ignore them. You understand them and explain them well to the rest of us. Let me ask you about North Korea, Gordon. Of course, as we have been discussing for some time, North Korea is a problem because of China as well. It enables it. But we're also being buffeted by information now, it seems, leaking out of the intelligence community to places like the Washington Post, that seems to be pretty strongly at odds with the sorts of assurances that President Trump thought he got from Kim Jong-un about denuclearization. Walk us through what we understand is going on in North Korea at the moment and its implications here in the United States as well.
Yeah, the regime in North Korea is continuing to produce fissile material. It also looks like it's actually increasing its production of uranium and plutonium. Also, we know that they're improving their 5-megawatt reactor at Yongbin. That has no peaceful purposes. And in the most recent revelation, the Washington Post reported that North Korea is continuing to produce its ICBMs, including its Hwasong-15, which the North Koreans tested last November 29th, which can hit the east coast of the United States. Frank, you put your finger on something I think is extremely critical. There have been a number of statements from President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo assuring the American public about North Korea's intentions and actually talking about their capabilities and what they're doing. And those seem to be contradicted by a series of leaks out of the U.S. intelligence community. So, for instance, in the middle of last week, Secretary Pompeo testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He mentioned, and matter of fact, he dodged the question of whether North Korea was actually continuing to produce missiles. Just a couple days after that, the Washington Post ran the story of leaked intelligence about the Hwasong-15 and other ICBMs being built at a particular facility outside of Pyongyang. So it seems like the IC is determined to get the truth out. And this means you must have some pretty alarmed and angry members of the IC, because these guys are actually putting their careers and their freedom at risk by disclosing this information. So this is a campaign, actually, against senior members of the administration. I'm not condoning it. I'm not, you know, I'm just saying what is actually, in fact, happening. People can draw their own conclusions whether this is a good thing or not.
Well, it comes in the midst of an awful lot of deep state subversion of the administration. But in this case, I think what is being laid before us is important for us to know about the abiding capabilities. And you made this distinction a moment ago, Gordon, between intentions and capabilities. You know, intelligence is supposed to focus on the capabilities, which are more enduring realities rather than the intentions, which can change at any moment. And in that connection, Gordon, I just wanted to emphasize another point, which I think bears a lot of focus, and that is what we're seeing, which you've just described quickly, is happening above ground in North Korea. That is to say, in facilities that the North Koreans surely know we can and are monitoring. My question is, if that's what's happening that they are confident we'll be able to observe, what are they doing in places that they know we can't observe? We may not even know are actually being involved in nuclear weapons programs, ballistic missile production, and the like, deep underground. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the North Koreans, more than any other regime, have really built a parallel military complex underground. They are the world's master tunnelers. And so, for instance, when the Iranians wanted to bury their nuclear weapons program, they turned to North Korean expertise as to how to put it underground. So I think you're absolutely right that we probably do not know, even in the intelligence community, do not know what the North Koreans are doing subsurface.
And this only adds to the intensity of the concern, I think, or should at least. Gordon, let me ask you about one other piece of this. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is currently on a trip to Asia. He is visiting with friendly nations there, in some cases allies, in the course of, among other things, attending the ASEAN meetings, the Southeast Asian community. To what extent do you think concerns about what is going on with North Korea and, for that matter, China are going to be front and center in his conversations?
I think clearly, because, you know, as we've been talking about, there is a large gap between what the administration has been saying publicly and what the North Koreans have been doing. Also, you know, there is concern in the region about the United States not stopping the North Koreans. So although Japan is not a member of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, it does have a links with the group. And, you know, Japan has every right to be concerned about what the North Koreans are doing, because they've often been the targets of North Korean hostility and North Korean actions. You know, this is going to be something that is a continuing theme, Frank, as the administration tries to create this good atmosphere for discussions with North Korea, thereby sort of sugarcoating what's occurring. And I think you're going to see it's not only the members of the intelligence community, but it's countries in Asia are actually starting to question the United States over its North Korea policies. This is not to say that President Trump can't pivot, that President Trump can't recalibrate and actually go back to a more successful and resolute policy like the one he had before the June 12th summit. But right now, I think there is this unease about what the United States is doing.
Yeah, and for him to be successful in what I think we both agree it would be desirable for him to accomplish, namely the denuclearization of North Korea, the end of the threat that it poses, he has to be seen by the North Koreans as well as the Chinese as serious. And I think efforts to suggest that the problem has gone away from the North is very much at odds with that, and the North Koreans know it. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. Look forward to doing so next week. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.